I very often don't want my pieces to feel like this was something that was just made to be in a gallery. I want it almost to be presented a little bit, not all of my work, but a lot of it, you know, where the viewer has this sense that this thing had a different life before it was brought here and hung on the wall.
Hello and welcome to episode 25 of Lo-Fi Podcast. I am John Wentz, recording conversations with artists, musicians, and filmmakers from my studio in Paris, France. Before getting started today, just want to give a thanks to the new reviews with stars and writings on Apple Podcasts. Really means a lot, helps out the podcast. If you can, please leave a review there, or if you can't, don't want to, totally understand. Maybe just recommend the podcast to somebody who you think would enjoy it. It really is going to help with future projects that I want to get off the ground. In this episode, I'm talking with my friend Eddie Kalla from Oakland, California. Eddie Kalla is a street artist, curator, and photographer based in Oakland, California. However, given his love and need for travel, you could possibly say he's based out of anywhere. His work is a synthesis of street art, collage, assemblage, and video that crosses and transcends the barriers between the gallery walls and the public space. Mixing photography, paint, wheat paste, and other materials he picked up working odd jobs in his beginnings, Eddie's work is a foreboding exploration and reminder of possible futures, and even more so today. I've known Eddie and his work for quite some time. When the COVID-19 pandemic first hit and the lockdowns began, I was reminded of the prescience of Eddie's imagery and decided to reach out for a conversation. In this episode, we talk about his beginnings in New Jersey and eventually enrolling in SVA. His then move from California to attend CCAC in Oakland. We also touch upon his work in the advertising world as a photographer, the transition into his iconic work Atavisms, the inexplicable life changes that led to his love for Paris, and much more. In closing, we talk about the upcoming online group show he organized with the help of Frederick Steimer, Carpe Diem. On Saturday, June 20th, more than 150 artists will unite to support medical research everywhere in France and in the world in a huge chain of solidarity. More than 150 artists will create works live on Instagram from the street or their workshops, which they will offer and then be sold for the benefit of the Foundation for Medical Research. Throughout this campaign, they will make calls for donations that will be collected through Gandhi.com. In addition to broadcasts, the YouTube channel will broadcast live performances, which will take place simultaneously on 5 continents and 2 hemispheres. The works produced will be sold through their partner, Monart, a platform using blockchain technology for total ease and security transactions. I'm excited and honored to be participating, so you can find more info in my personal Instagram at JohnWentz, one word, or in the show notes. From his website. Eddie attended the School of Visual Arts in New York and graduated from the California College of Arts with a BFA in Photography / Interdisciplinary Fine Arts in 1991. He began his artistic career as a photographer, working first for the New York Times and later countless magazines, record labels, and ad agencies. 15 years later, he has morphed into one who counters the all-pervasive nature of commercialism in public spaces. Since 2005, his wheat paste and stencils can be found throughout public spaces in the Bay Area, Los Angeles, and Miami. Eddie's work first began to garner national recognition when his street art began incorporating images of Barack Obama throughout the 2008 presidential election. His growing popularity landed him attention on internet blogs, features in 6 published books, and participation in the Manifest Hope Art Gallery shows at the 2008 Democratic National Convention and at the presidential inauguration in Washington, D.C. His designs have been transformed many times over from stickers, albums, and magazine covers. This interview was recorded on Tuesday, June 2nd, via the internet in my studio in Paris, France. So without further delay, I hope you enjoy this conversation with Eddie Kalla.
And I think that's where we're at. We have a populace that's been incredibly manipulated and don't even know it.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. So I don't know if it's because I know you, but I've always felt that your work carries political undertones. but I do recall I read in an interview once that you said that your work is becoming less political. And I think in part you said because you refuse to take part in it.
You know, I did. I used to be kind of like, in other words, I would do, I'd do street pieces that were about something that happened yesterday. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I would do these sort of current event pieces that were, would address the news of the day or something that was very topical at the moment.
Okay.
And I was pretty involved in that for a number of years, and then I sort of walked away from it, not necessarily because I thought it wasn't worthwhile. It had more to do with my life changing, and I think my perspective at the time just became a lot more introverted and a lot less extroverted.
Mm-hmm.
So I started to look. So I think my work is still political, but it's political in a much more broad sense. It's not about specific issues or a specific event. It's more about a sort of direction that we sort of head when we make these decisions. What happens to people? So I think more it's become less about day-to-day politics and more about just about people as a species and what traits we kind of inherently have and what traits are things that we've adopted as a form, as a part of the environment, whether it's political environment or the physical environment, our social environment. I think some traits that we have are just kind of instinctual, and some traits that we, and also some traits that we have are dormant for a long time, and given a certain set of circumstances, they reemerge. So I use this word atavisms all the time because it describes this sort of part of a species' DNA that remains in their DNA, but basically goes dormant because it's not needed.
Right.
So that would be like whales having feet. Like that still exists in their DNA.
Mm-hmm.
It's not expressed because they don't need it. And occasionally through some freak, genetic mutation, it comes back out because the DNA is in the whale. The DNA to create a foot is in the whale. It doesn't use it because of evolution. And I think people are the same. And I think a lot of things like about our behaviors, about tribalism and about sort of mob mentality, and so, our way of being sort of survivalist aren't necessarily a part of the way the modern world works. But given the right set of circumstances, those traits reemerge overnight. You could even see it in COVID a little bit. The way people's attitudes just changed. The way, what everybody's calling the new normal emerged in 14 days. So yeah, I think my work has changed a lot. Work is a funny thing though right now. At the beginning of this, I thought, trying to see the opportunity in things. Like, this is a terrible thing. I'll be home for a while. This is an opportunity to work on things maybe I hadn't had a chance to get to. I don't know. I mean, how have you been creative wise? Because I've not been good at all.
Yeah. It's funny because when the COVID thing first hit, a lot of people that I knew or that I saw online said they couldn't work. They didn't see any reason in working or whatever. It was too overwhelming. And it was the opposite for me. It was the most productive I think I'd been in a long time. And I think that was because the world was finally on my level.
Yeah.
Like, everything was calm. This is normally how I am. Like, each day is the same. I'm in the studio. It's a very hermetic existence, more or less. But then for me, it completely changed 180 degrees as soon as the tragedy of George Floyd happened. And now with, the unrest and the protests and the riots, I don't see any reason to work. It just doesn't make sense to me right now.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's that overwhelming thing, like that all the things that are going on right now are so much more important.
Yeah, exactly. Even on like an existential level, when I see humanity right now just killing each other, I don't see any purpose in pushing dirt around with hairs on a stick. It doesn't make any sense to me whatsoever. And then I wake up this morning to that ridiculous photo opportunity that Trump took in front of the church. And I'm just...
Oh, where the president tear gassed innocent people so he could go take a picture?
Exactly.
Holding a book he never read in front of a church he never attended?
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, just on a level of propaganda, the layers.
Oh, it's unbelievable.
That. Yeah. And just knowing that his base, that base that propaganda was targeted at, the evangelicals, are going to eat that up, you know, despite the obvious.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
BS, yeah.
I mean, look, you know, for all intents and purposes, I'm an atheist, but I went to...
Yeah, same here.
I went to 12 years of Catholic school. I'm familiar with the book.
So am I. Same thing.
And there's nothing about that man that reflects any of the values or ethics presented in that book.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, and just the obvious pandering to that base by, what was it, giving like a stimulus money, bailing out the churches that were getting affected by COVID because they were having low in attendance, you know, and that's taxpayer money going to that.
Yeah. But this is where we, you know, I mean, I'm pissed off that I shouldn't even be here, you know. I basically came back to the States for a 6 to 8 week stint because I had some work that I had to finish and I had a couple of jobs and I thought, okay, I'll come back here. And then the plan was I'll go to Hong Kong because I have a place to stay there. So me and my girlfriend were going to go to Hong Kong and we're going to hang out there for a while. And then I had this big mural I was going to do in Cambodia. So the virus comes along and I think, well, maybe now's not the best time to go to Hong Kong. They share a border with mainland China. This is probably not going to go well. Maybe I need to hang back and wait to see how it plays out. And then I got stuck here, which is the worst place to be.
Oh, yeah, you know? 100%.
I mean, Hong Kong has no problem with the virus. It's almost gone. You know, I talked to a friend over there last week, and they said, well, if we don't have a case in the next 2 days, that will be 14 days without any new cases. Mm-hmm. And so everything's going to be loosened up a little bit. And my friends in Cambodia, same thing. I mean, they have a few cases, but no serious problems.
All right.
So, yeah, I made the mistake of betting that the United States would be more stable in a pandemic situation. Of course, I was absolutely 100% wrong.
And it's so mind-boggling because by all rights, it should be.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cambodia handled this better.
Yeah. A lot of places with far less advances in science and medicine and with less money did better.
Well, it's outrageous. I mean, you know, the one thing I've noticed about the protests, it's funny. We were definitely more prepared for riots than we were for a pandemic.
Oh, always.
The cops aren't running out of tear gas. You know,
no, not cops at all.
Cops aren't running out of rubber bullets, and yet we didn't have medical supplies for our medical workers.
Yeah,
you know, and I mean, I spent a good chunk of change gathering stuff up because I had friends in China and Hong Kong and places where masks were available.
God, it shouldn't be like that.
And contacting them and getting them to ship stuff to me so I could get it to the hospitals. I mean, that's crazy when citizens have to go and start procuring medical supplies so that people who work in hospitals can do their jobs.
Yeah. Yeah. And even though it's always shocking, you know, to the rest of the world, it's no shock to us. You look at our healthcare system, how many people have to go to GoFundMe for healthcare? It's absurd.
We're the richest country in the world. You know, and we can't do that.
Yeah. I've had friends with cancer that have had to do crowdfunding for the treatment.
You know, it's insane. And in the last 5 years, I've spent most of my time outside of the country. And the two most frequent questions I get from people in other countries, the first would be like, is it true that people really can like lose everything because they get sick?
Right.
You know?
Exactly.
even in places with that don't have socialized medicine, just where, you know, medicine is reasonably priced, you know, or affordable. Treatments are affordable, so you're not going to go bankrupt if you get sick. That would be the first question. And the second question is consistently, why does the United States treat Black people the way they treat Black people?
How do you answer that?
I don't necessarily answer it. I don't know what I could say that would change anything. You know, it's like people will tell me what they see, and I can just say, yes, that's true. And they'll say, why is it that way? And I'll say, I don't really understand it because, and I don't really understand it because I grew up in New Jersey, which is not the most open-minded place necessarily. Specifically where I grew up and within my own family and stuff, people didn't tolerate that shit. And it wasn't because we were so diverse. It was a white neighborhood. It was predominantly white. For whatever reason, I didn't grow up around people who discussed race that way. You know, everybody was pretty fair and open-minded, and it just wasn't a part of my upbringing. So I literally don't understand it. Because I never lived any place like that.
Mm-hmm.
I've lived places like that since, but it's not a part of my history really. So when people ask me why things are like that, I don't know what to tell them. I remember one night, me and Night Owl, we were in Paris and we were over on up by Pigalle on Clignancourt.
Oh yeah.
And we were just walking around putting up some pieces and shit like that. Stopped and got a couple of beers at the corner shop, sitting in the park, drinking our beers. It's like 2 o'clock in the morning. And this neighborhood guy kind of came over and he's just chit-chatting. And it was a African guy. And he said, where are you guys from? We told him where we're from. He said, I feel sorry for my people in your country.
Damn.
And I was just like, so completely embarrassed and kind of ashamed, and like was really trying to rack my brain for something to say that would at least demonstrate that, you know, everybody in the United States doesn't feel that way.
Right.
You know, it's not hopeless. And I couldn't find anything that could change anything. You know, it was just this helplessness. You know, I just had to sort of sit there. And I mean, I acted like a little kid. The guy said it, and I just started staring at my shoes, you know, kind of ashamed of myself.
Yeah.
You know, like I just didn't have anything worth saying. That's a hard thing to, you know, I'm a grown ass man. You know, most, I don't generally. Right. Get put in situations where my response is to stare at my shoes like I'm a 5-year-old ashamed of myself. I mean, all you do is you live your life and you try and, I don't know, you just try and be an example to other people. You try to live your life right and hopefully other people pick up on that.
Yeah.
And when you see things that are wrong, you say something. And I mean, above and beyond that, and you vote and you protest.
Right.
But I mean, it gets, you know, part of my issue, I was talking to my sister like a week ago, you know, and you were just chit-chatting or whatever. And she's asking, oh, you know, like, well, are you at least getting a lot of work done? You know, because I've been home for so long.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, it can't work. Like, I'm not. I mean, I've done things, you know, but not really. I just can't work. And she was like, well, why can't you work? And I said, I feel like with everything that's going on, I feel like I'm in an environment of blind people. So what's the point of making a picture?
Right.
Like, what could I possibly say about the current situation as an artist that isn't right in front of everybody?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So this isn't, I mean, I don't feel like this is a situation that we're in politically in this country where this is all going on in backroom discussions. I mean, it's blatantly right there on the surface. So what could I say that would be a greater indictment of this administration or this president than what they say themselves? you know? And if you can't see that, what is it that I could possibly show you? If you're so blind or so convinced of whatever else you think is going on, I don't know what I could say to you that would change your mind.
Do you think it's pointless to even make art at a time like this?
No, I don't think it's pointless. I think I get overwhelmed with that feeling. I would encourage everybody to get rid of that feeling and carry on. I haven't been super effective myself at tackling that. That's the overwhelming feeling that I get. That it's just like, well, I can't. What could I possibly do? What's the point of making, it's like making music for deaf people.
Yeah, I think that's a perfect analogy. Yeah, it really hits home. We talked, I think around in the beginning or at some point during the lockdown about your work and mentioned how scarily prescient it seems, in hindsight, especially, from about 4 years ago onwards.
Well, I think in a way, what I was trying to do was to, it's a little bit like shine a flashlight on this thing, because everything I could find when dealing with like what happens in an apocalyptic situation pointed right to this. And I don't think it's surprising to any, I don't think anybody in the science community is surprised that this happened. I think this is exactly.
No, they've been talking about it.
Yeah, I mean, the pandemic playbook. And all I was doing with my art was paying attention to that and saying, well, what if that does happen? What does that look like? Which I felt like in the first kind of, when I first did it, I kind of felt like, okay, well, that's very kind of negative. Not negative, but very, it was just offering a vision of what that might look like. And then the work changed a bit after that because I thought, well, let me try and focus not so much on the events or the specifics of it, but on the elements of people that sort of can't be stripped away from them. The portraits changed because they became a lot more about strength and dignity in the face of sort of hardship or struggle. So I did the first show I did at GCA Gallery was called Inviolable. So that's exactly what that was. It was supposed to be this. If all these things fall away, all these constructs of government and economies and all these things, and they're very fragile. We think they're not fragile, but I think we've seen that they're very fragile. If all those things that we've constructed, this sort of civilization, this way of exchanging money or moving or traveling or even interacting with people, if all that goes away, what is left in people? What is the stuff that can't be taken away from us? And that as lofty as that sounds, that's what I was trying to photograph.
No, I don't think it sounds lofty at all. I'm curious, though, and this is taking a bit of a step backwards, but how do you get to that? Because your background, you went to SVA, right? And you studied photography. So how do you get there from photography?
I did. I went to SVA for a short period. I went to CCAC. I left for a while and I went back to New Jersey where I'm from. And while I was there, I was going to SVA.
Oh, okay.
Then I returned to CCAC and graduated.
Okay, I see. But I'm curious, though, the trajectory. Like, how do you get from shooting advertising to then get into this work of this caliber? And I don't know if it's the right way to say this level of thought, but of this concept.
Oh, it's completely. But here's the thing about that's a little, life is never what you think it's going to be, right?
Yeah, so apparently.
I went to school. I studied photography. Well, I studied a lot of things. I studied photography primarily, but I studied painting. I studied drawing. I studied filmmaking. I studied a lot of different sort of things. But I focused primarily on photography because at the time that seemed to be what I was best at.
Okay.
I never had any ambition to be a photojournalist or an advertising photographer or any of that.
Mm-hmm.
My intent was to be an artist, You know, and most of my work, probably when I first got out of school, was a lot more like the work that I do now than that sort of 12 years in the middle where I sort of survived as a commercial photographer. Oh, but okay. All into it by accident. You know, I had a teacher in my third year of school who was a photo editor named Philip Gefter. And have you ever seen the film Bill Cunningham's New York?
No, I haven't.
It's a documentary about a photographer from the New York Times, and I would recommend it. It's great. I don't even want to tell you too much about it. Just have some faith and go watch it.
Okay.
He produced that, but I had taken him my third year in college. He left. He moved to New York. He became a picture editor at the New York Times. And when I was like 21 years old, I graduated from school and I went back to New Jersey. And he called me up and he said, "Hey, I'm going to give you an assignment for the New York Times."
Wow.
And I was like, I'm not a photojournalist. And he said, "Well, just do it. We'll see what happens." Mm-hmm. You know? So went out and did it. It worked out okay. And it's probably one of the biggest things that ever changed my life as an artist, because and you probably know this, when you graduate from art school with an art degree, you know, the most commonly asked question is, "What the fuck are you going to do?" Yep. You know what I mean? So, you know, your family's sort of like worried about you, like, "What is he going to do? All he knows how to do is make art. Like, what is he going to do for a living?"
Yeah. How are you going to make money?
Right. So within 6 months of graduating, I was like, "Oh yeah, you know, I got a picture in the New York Times today." And that just shut everybody up. So I didn't have to battle with this sort of ongoing, you know, external voices of doubt. Like, what are you going to do? How are you going to get by? You know, everybody just went, "Oh, okay." And they left me alone, which gave me the room to sort of believe I could do this.
Right.
Because I mean, when you were younger, I mean, obviously now you have a big, long career and you're sort of confident in what you do and who you are and how that works. But, you know, when you were in your 20s or you just got out of academy, what was your feeling about the future? Were you 100% sure that you were going to continue to be an artist?
Honestly, I think yes, but I don't think it wasn't anything out of any type of like intense self-confidence. In all honesty, I think it's because I'm probably kind of stupid in a way.
I don't mean, yeah, you're stupid. I mean, yes, I understand.
You know, or it's more like a naivety is what it was. But I didn't know it was going to be like this. That's the thing. I thought it would be something entirely different. So I had no idea this is what it would be like.
I had this idea in my head that I have to make this work.
Yeah, exactly.
Because I don't have a backup plan. I'm not even sure if I'm good at this, but I know I'm not really good at anything else. That was my, you know, I think of all the things I might be good at, this might be the best one. And the other ones I know I'm definitely not good at.
Right.
So, And I did a lot of shit for a long time that was not art related. You know, I was a sheetrocker for a long time. So
really,
I hung sheetrock. I painted a lot of houses. You know, all kinds of stuff like that. And most of my earning money part of my life was all sort of blue collar stuff.
Yeah.
You know, when I was a kid, I striped parking lots.
Really? The painted lines?
Yeah. I mean, it's just, you know, I worked with this old guy who was kind of very much an example to me, you know, like my parents got divorced. My dad wasn't around. This guy was kind of like the guy who taught me how to work. Like, this is what a man does to make a living, you know, and he was just this hardworking dude. And crazy and eccentric as fuck, but had a huge effect on me and kind of taught me the value of just a day's work, you know. And I started working for him, like, I was like 13 years old, and I had no idea what a day at work was like. Like, I remember the first day I ever worked for this guy. I was 13, and it was like, you know, a 9 or 10 hour day. It was in the summer in New Jersey. It was hot as hell. I mean, the most I had ever done, mowed some lawns in the neighborhood, shoveled some snow for $5 or $10. I had no idea what work life was like. Here I was, I'm like 13 years old, and they're asking me to carry around these like 50-pound bags of sand. And I'm like this skinny little fuck. But, I mean, it was great. I mean, the guy, like, taught me to what you were capable of. And so that's what I did. Oddly enough, that's also the first time I ever stenciled anything, because we stenciled everything. We would stencil all the numbers on parking lots. We would stencil
even the handicap signs?
Yeah, the handicap signs, the reserve signs. So, I mean, that's also like the first time I kind of got introduced to like, oh, this is kind of cool. This is kind of a cool way to make things. You know, you can just spray paint shit through holes.
So did you consciously pull from that experience then and make it a part of your work, or do you think it was unconscious?
Well, I think the funny thing about, you know, doing construction and doing sheetrock and painting lines in parking lots is that by doing that, my work now probably has much more materials from those days than it does from an art store.
Right.
You know, I almost rarely use art materials. You know, most of the stuff is stuff that I learned how to use working on houses. I think I carry more of what I learned from that than what I learned from art school. Aside from being in art school, I've never done an oil painting.
What did you get out of art school then?
What did I get out of art school? That's a good question. Well, I learned basic theory about things like composition and color. And I didn't know anything about that. So I did learn those things. I also got to be in an environment for 4 years where I was really able to do whatever I wanted to do.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that space was super valuable. I think I made a lot of really shitty art, and still do.
You kind of have to.
But I had that room where everything wasn't, you know, when you're studying art, you're in an environment where everything's not, there's a little bit more openness to, here's an idea, here's the way I'm trying to present it, this is what I'm trying to do. You know, if I were to go home and just show that to my aunt and my brothers and sisters, they would be like, I don't know what the fuck you're talking about. But, you know, in that environment, I could do that. And then I also got to see people who made a living making art,
mm-hmm.
which was not something I truly believed either. You know,
right.
Oddly enough, this is very different than most people's experience with their parents. I was encouraged by both of my parents to go to art school.
I almost can't believe that.
It's a funny thing. My parents, yeah, I mean, for whatever I can say good or bad about them, they had a decent amount of foresight. In other words, they looked at me and they thought, I remember my mom said this to me once, long after I graduated. She sort of said, you never would have made it through 1 year of regular college. You would have just quit.
Wow.
You would have went back to striping parking lots with Ted. Which she's absolutely right. That's exactly what I would have done. Uh-huh. I would have had no interest in going to a regular college, a regular academic college. I would have gotten bored. I wouldn't have done shit the same as I didn't do shit in high school. And then I would have went back to striping parking lots because it was a job I liked and I made a lot of money. And I never would have become an artist.
Did either of them have an artistic background at all?
You know what? My mom has no artistic inclination at all, but she likes art. But she doesn't draw. She doesn't, but she appreciates art.
Okay. I see.
It's a funny thing with my parents got divorced. My mom went back to school, you know, at like 35 years old to get her college degree. And one of the classes she took was an art appreciation class as part of her core curriculum. And she really got into art. She like really enjoyed it. And when I was a little kid, she would do things like, I remember taking me to these little like, at the Met in New York on Saturdays, they would have like these arts and crafts things for kids. And she'd take me to these, and I didn't want to go, but she'd go, no, go, it'll be really good. I thought, oh, okay, fuck this, it's going to be boring. And I would go, and I would make stuff, and I'd be super excited about it. You know, what you can imagine, you know, you'd be making stuff out of clay and tinfoil. And,
you know. Yeah, they have it at MoMA.
Yeah. So it was like stuff like that, but, you know, but then, and then she would take me up to the museum, and we'd walk around. And that was unusual. Like where I grew up, I mean, going to the Metropolitan Museum of Art was not something that most parents took their kids to do on the weekends. So that was just this funny fluke that my mom had taken this class, you know, when she was going back to college and she got interested in me. And then she just, I think both of them looked at me and thought like, yeah, he's not like college material, you know, but he likes making this stuff. So maybe we could encourage that.
Yeah. So their strategy was just kind of get out of your way.
Yeah. Yeah. It was sort of, and I remember like in my last year of high school, you know, when you're starting to think about, well, am I going to go to college? What am I going to do? I had no idea what I was going to do. You know, I thought, well, maybe I just won't go to college. And I had this little, there was this little art center in the middle of my town. That was like a community center, you know, and you could go there and take like a life drawing class or some shit like mm-hmm. that. You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
So my mom came home from work one day and she said, oh yeah. You know, she said, on Tuesday, you got to go to the art center. I enrolled you in this class. And I said, well, what kind of class? And she said, it's a portfolio preparation class. And I was like, I don't know what that is. And she said, they're going to help you put together a body of work to show to art school so you can apply to art school. And I said, but I was like, I'm not applying to art school. She's like, yeah, no, you're going to apply to some art school.
That's really encouraging. Because
to me, I thought, well, what are you going to go to art school for? You can't make a living as an artist. Like, I didn't grow up around, you know, artists and musicians and stuff. You know, I just grew up around regular middle class people.
Uh-huh.
And I didn't believe you could make, you know, a living doing.
How were you going to tackle tuition? Because SVA is not cheap.
No, you know what? Here's a funny thing, man. I'll tell you, like, back in the day, when I first got into CCAC, it was super cheap.
Really?
Yeah. Now, I'm that old. But my tuition at CCAC was, you know, less than half of what any of my brothers and sisters' college tuitions were.
Wow, that's insane.
You know, so I think the first year I went to CCAC, the tuition for the entire year, both semesters, was, I think, $5,500. And I got a dorm room with that.
Yeah. That's unbelievable.
So it wasn't...
Yeah, it's easily the reverse now. And you wouldn't get a dorm room then.
No. I mean, I've talked to people since, you know. I mean, we used to have, you know, when I had the t-shirt company, we had people who graduated from CCAC and they would come and work for us. And, you know, I'd be like, what's it cost to go there these days? And it was like $30,000 a year or $35,000 a year. And I was like, that's fucking crazy.
Yeah, and higher now.
You know, like you're going to be paying for that for the rest of your life.
Literally.
At the time when I did it, it was still pretty reasonable. And SVA was slightly more expensive, but not really dramatically more expensive.
So I don't know what your experience was like then, but generally, like my experience in art school is coming out and through it, you're being poised towards just presenting to galleries.
Yeah, absolutely.
So did you
and
go?
And mostly what I was doing when I got out of.
Did you go that route at all?
I did. I got out of art school. Most of the stuff I was doing was sort of like photography mixed with sort of assemblage and found objects. And I was making kind of installations and things like that. And I mean, now this is a long time ago. This is when we used to have sheets of slides. You'd even send your sheets of slides to the gallery.
Oh, yeah. Same here.
Okay. So, and I never took, there was not one digital photography class when I was at school. Actually, I think there was one. I didn't take it, but it was like the first one. And it was a joke. I mean, cameras were so bad. Photoshop was so bad. Everything looked like completely pixelated. Everything took 2 hours to render, and it was terrible.
Working on like a 6 meg card.
Yeah. No, I mean, people were still had shit on floppy disks.
Wow.
So that was like, you know, early 90s or whatever.
Man.
But no, so I did pursue, you know, I got out of college and, you know, I made my slides and I sent my work around and I had my artist statement, and my CV and my bio and never, you know, I got into some group shows and stuff, but I wasn't, first of all, you know, I never got more than a piece or two in a group show. I never got a solo show and I didn't make any money. I never sold anything. So photography was a little bit more useful, so I started doing that to make money. So I would work for the New York Times, which was not a lot of money at the time. You would go out and do an assignment, and I think it was $150. know, that's what you would get paid. So I had all these other regular jobs back then. I worked in a call center for Clairol Hair Color for like a year.
Man, that's a long commitment.
Yeah, well, it was only part time.
Oh, okay.
And it actually wasn't as bad as it sounds. I mean, the customers were kind of horrendous.
Of course.
But pretty much it was one of these deals where it was part-time. So almost everybody who worked in the call center was like an artist or a dancer or somebody pursuing something else. So it was actually kind of a cool group of people. Oh, but right. Yeah, it was a fucking weird job.
Yeah.
But it paid well.
So how did you begin the transition from gallery work and pursuing gallery work at all to outdoor work and street art? Eventually what you started doing.
I mean, it's interesting. When I was a teenager, you know, I would do sort of like some half-assed graffiti crap like that. I would also make, make like all these little homemade stickers that I would like put on the subway trains and stuff like that. You know, just to, not that I thought it was just for me, you know, I thought it was funny. And back then, there was no Flickr or Instagram. Nobody was taking pictures of this shit. And I never knew what happened to any of it. It was just like, you would just put it out there and go home with that good feeling that like somebody saw that today. I think somebody saw that today. So you would just do these little projects just to kill time. You know, it's a funny thing. When I was young in the 90s, I feel like because there was no internet, there were no cell phones, I feel like I just had all this time.
Oh yeah, I know what you mean.
So I would make fucking zines that nobody ever saw just because I wanted to see it. Uh-huh. You know, uh-huh. I would do these public art projects that probably nobody ever saw and nobody ever photographed. And, you know, I never signed and they just sort of disappeared. And, I mean, I was remembering today when I was 21 going out the night before the Rodney King verdict and changing all these billboards in the subways in New York.
Changing what about them? Like doing what?
There used to be all these billboards. I don't know if you remember this. I mean, granted, this was not my best work. But in New York City subways, there used to be all these billboards for this thing called the Club. And it was this big bar you would put on your steering wheel.
Oh, yeah. I remember that.
Uh-huh. To prevent people from stealing your car.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
So there were all these billboards in the New York City subways. And basically what it had was, you know, it was just a black billboard. And it said, the Club. Police say use it or lose it, right? And it had a little picture of the club. So I just went and took over all these billboards and basically where the image of the club was, I put four screenshots from the Rodney King beating, mm-hmm. like video things, wow. Video stills.
Yeah.
And then so it was just this black billboard with four stills from the Rodney King beating and I just blacked out or lose it. So it just said the club, police say use it.
Oh, man.
And I just changed a whole bunch of them. And it was the night before the deliberations, before the officers were to be where they gave the verdict.
Right, right.
You know, and then it was just like me and this girl I knew. And we just went around at like 2 o'clock in the morning. And, uh-huh. You know, I mean, it was the subway was different then. It wasn't a surveillance state. There weren't cameras everywhere. Nobody tried to stop us. Nobody cared.
Right.
Nobody even knew what the fuck we were doing. So we just went around and we did like, I don't know, four or five of these things. And then we went home. And then the next day I got up and Los Angeles was on fire. And it was great. And that's what I mean about what's going on right now. It's like this common thread, you know, throughout my entire adult life. You know, that was 1992.
Right. It's almost cyclical. What is
that? I did those, you know, in 2008. We had a New Year's Eve party here at the loft and we all sat on the loading dock because we were all drinking and barbecuing and setting off fireworks. And we saw all the cop cars going to Fruitvale for Oscar Grant.
Oh, I remember that.
And we all sat there, you know, partying, having a good time, being like, what the fuck is going on? You know, woke up the next day, that happened.
Right.
Did a bunch of pieces about Oscar Grant, you know, that sort of, that's an interesting, I got, you know, they did that movie, Fruitvale Station.
Yeah, I never saw it, but I remember.
So I got a call from Miramax to do a mural for that, you know.
Okay.
And I had done this piece that was like this, it was like a gorilla as a cop. and he's like kind of holding his baton and stuff. And,
whoa.
I wouldn't say it was great, but you know, I was trying to get my point across. It wasn't subtle.
Right.
And then the background was just this list of 35 people. And it said, like, no more excuses on it. So then I got this call from Miramax, or not Miramax, I guess Weinstein Company.
Oh.
Which that has a halt.
Right, yeah.
This was, this was before that. And they said, oh, well, we're putting out this movie, Fruitvale Station. We saw your work, and we'd like you to do a mural.
Uh-huh.
And I thought, okay, that's great. I'd love to do that, you know, because it'll give my, you know, this message some exposure and tie it to the event that it's actually about.
It's important, yeah.
And then the whole thing just became a clusterfuck, you know. I mean, I submitted the proposal, and they wrote me back, and the director gave me this big criteria, you know.
Jeez.
The image couldn't contain images of cops. He didn't want it to be about cops.
What?
You know, he didn't want it to be about Oscar Grant's death. He didn't, you know, and I was just, and so eventually I just said, well, no, I'm not doing it, because I don't know. I don't even know what this is about anymore.
Yeah, it's kind of
absurd. It seemed like this super safe project. They didn't want to tackle the issue directly. And it was a little bit of this, like, well, we want the film to be a celebration of Oscar Grant's life. And it's like, look, man, if he didn't get killed the way he was killed, by who he was killed, you wouldn't be making a movie about his life.
Yeah, it's just propaganda. It's completely off topic at that
point. Yeah. And then, you know, it's like, you know, we want to show who Oscar Grant was. And it's like, and I just have a problem with that in general. I think a lot of times when these things happen where people are murdered, people feel as if they need to go out and say what an exceptional person this was.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
And that bothers me a lot, because it shouldn't be wrong to kill a man because he's exceptional.
Uh-huh.
It's wrong to kill a man because he's innocent. He could be completely unexceptional. It's still just as wrong.
Yeah.
He could be as flawed as the rest of us. You know, I mean, look at any of us. I mean, if you look through my past, there are examples of me not behaving particularly well, you know, of not conducting myself well. And it's like this idea to try that we have to in some way put these people forward as being exceptional or great people or, you know, virtuous people.
Uh-huh.
That shouldn't even be a consideration. People shouldn't have to be virtuous or exceptional to not be murdered.
Right.
They should not be murdered because they're innocent.
Yeah, 100%. I totally agree. And also, in this day and age, like with the situation going on now, and it comes out that he may have been on fentanyl, and somehow that preemptively creates or gives room for this binary argument. So on one end, it was a saint, and that means it was terrible. Uh-oh, they may have been less of what we thought because it could have been drunk or on drugs. So that somehow makes it okay or lessens the severity.
Yeah.
It's ridiculous. And I mean, completely disgusting, and people buy into it.
Well, I mean, it's just ridiculous. I mean, the country's so incredibly judgmental. It's like, what are we, like a nation of Puritans?
Sort of.
I drink, you drink. Does that mean if we're drunk, that means it's okay to kill us?
Right, right.
You know what I mean? I mean, it's a ridiculous argument. You know, if that guy, whatever, got in a fist fight 2 weeks before outside a bar because he had too much to drink, that means it's okay to kill him? Bullshit. You know, I mean, that's just, and it goes, and that's, and I think all those things are just distractions. You know, we all get distracted on this idea. We lose focus of the point, and the point is somebody who's innocent was murdered by the very people who were supposed to enforce the law. That's the point.
Yeah, absolutely.
The quality of that person's character is not what we're questioning. You know, they didn't have to be the best citizen in the entire world. Who amongst us is?
Right.
You know, we all have our, like I said, I mean, you know, you could, you know, I mean, if somebody wanted to dig hard enough into my past, we wouldn't even have to dig that hard. Like, you know, I mean, this guy did this. Yeah. I mean, this guy did this, you know, you could easily present that and say, like, I'm just a fucking menace to society. I don't think that I am. I think I've done some stupid things.
We all have.
But you could paint anybody that way.
Right.
You know, and that's the thing. But it's all just a distraction. I mean, and that's the problem with the way the media sort of follows some of these things. And not, you know, some of it's much better than others. You know, I mean, I get my news from a couple of sources that I kind of trust.
Yeah, so do I.
Above and beyond that, I kind of avoid. I don't really click on. I don't really use Facebook very much.
Yeah,
but I don't. I certainly don't get news from Facebook.
No, that's the worst thing you could do.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm constantly having arguments with my friends who have sent me a link to an article. It's like, do you know anything about the publication that put out this article? And they'll say, well, no. You know, and then you'll tell them, no. Do you know who it's owned by? Do you know, like, where the money comes from? No, they have no idea. They just read it and they think it's true. And that's unbelievable to me. I mean, I don't know how you feel about that. I mean, the internet is like, you would think in 2020 everybody would have the good sense to just do a little bit of background search. And still they just sort of believe everything they read.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. But I think a part of it, it comes down to what you were bringing up earlier, is critical thinking. I mean, it's education. It's something we definitely don't spend enough time on in our educational system. And it's really frustrating, like frustrates me to no end, that you literally have all the information in the world, at least that we know, at your fingertips. But I, you know, with that being said, I try to be a bit forgiving because I understand, you know, probably what's happens, right, is it's just so overwhelming. And there are so many sources that you choose the path of least resistance.
I just think people, if you want to be well informed, you have an obligation to yourself to check where your information's coming.
Yeah, totally agree. And that's kind of the paradox of it, right? Is that we have access to all this information, but now it takes more diligence and it puts more responsibility on the individual. And like you said, to inform yourself and to educate yourself.
How much do you do to sort of protect yourself and your information when you're online?
Like in clicking terms and agreements and stuff like that?
No, in terms of like how you connect or what apps you use or what permissions you have enabled.
I'm not really that good with that stuff or as diligent as I should be. I think I kind of got lazy and given up because my concern is more geared towards the facial recognition. Like it was really frightening about halfway, you know, into quarantine when that Facebook avatar thing came out and everybody's doing these Facebook avatars out of boredom and, you know, to keep themselves entertained. But all you're doing is giving away all your facial recognition, all that information. And that's going to be worth billions of dollars and gives up all your anonymity.
Well, that's what the whole 10-year challenge is about.
Right, right.
Yeah, yeah.
But Instagram is a major collector of information as well, of course. It's just different. Like something, I had a friend tell me about somebody who's in tech and has worked in algorithms and had some kind of tie, I forget exactly what it is, to Instagram. But, you know, people are always looking for these Instagram hacks, you know, ways to get your stuff seen. And there's, from what I understand and what I've been told from people behind the scenes, there's none. I know people have all their theories and there's all these YouTube videos. But he was saying that one of the surefire ways is for posts that put a lot of writing in there. And that's actually one of the reasons I don't do that. Because the hard data they can collect is in all the stuff that you put in. I mean, it is hard data. Mm-hmm. Keywords, all these things about yourself. Like people write these diary entries. So I hardly put any information in there because that's just data to get mined.
Yeah. Yeah, right. Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. It's, you know, especially with artists, it's like, you know, all this content that we create, content, you know, remember when we used to make art?
Right. Oh, don't get me started on that.
No, we make content now, and we're brands. We're not artists anymore. We're brands.
Yeah, we're essentially advertisers. That's what it's come down to. Yeah, art's on the wayside.
Yeah, you know, I'm starting to feel that way too. Like, yeah, maybe I'm just getting old or whatever, but like the world makes less and less sense to me.
Oh, yeah, I feel you.
But I mean, I've gone on this thing where now it's just like I don't use Chrome. I don't use I use different browsers other than the sort of mainstream browsers with a lot more sort of blocking ability.
Oh, yeah. There's like Opera and DuckDuckGo.
When I went to China, I had to get a VPN because you kind of need a VPN to access things like Facebook and Instagram because it blocked in China.
Right.
So they just reroute your signal through a different country.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really useful. I use it here.
So I never got rid of the VPN because I was like, oh, this is great. Like everything I do on this phone now is kind of encrypted and comes from a different server. And because it's just, I never have my location on. I mean, it's a little bit weird the length that I go to or people should go to just to protect their own. I mean, I'm not really trying to hide anything, but I also just ideologically disagree with the idea that I should have this beacon on my phone and somewhere, you know.
Yeah, yeah. We saw this with the COVID apps where they were tracking your location, and granted it was for good, but that's again just hard data that they can use for surveillance. I mean, what are those apps doing after the fact?
Yeah. And it's like, you know, the whole idea of like sort of surveillance capitalism is just scary.
Yeah, we're already there.
And it's with, you know, so I'll say to people, you should get a VPN, you know, because it's helpful. You know, your data's blocked. And they'll be like, oh, doesn't that cost money? And it's like, yeah, it costs like $9 a month. Like, is that, it's like two cups of coffee.
That's really inexpensive. Like, right.
You don't think you're where you travel and what you know, all these things are worth $9 a month to not end up in the.
Yeah, well, it's like that thing, if it doesn't affect you immediately, then it's not a problem, you know, and you could use that for something much more entertaining, like some kind of farming game.
I mean, I think one of the best things I ever did, and I didn't do it for I did it for other reasons, but, you know, I don't really have any pictures. There's really no pictures of me on the internet.
Yeah, I wanted to ask about that because I didn't know if that had anything to do with your art making or with, you know.
I mean, I think a part of it did at first. You know, I thought, well, I don't really want people to be able to recognize me. You know, I mean, I was doing street art that was pretty benign. I don't think anybody was going to kind of come out and come after me. I wasn't like hitting high profile spaces or anything. But I also thought, well, that's not to say that I won't in the future. And it would, you know, once something's on the internet, it's kind of on there forever. And it's like, I don't necessarily want to be recognizable per se. You know, I don't want some stranger to be able to go and say, what's this guy look like? So, you know, I can see if I can find him at this gallery opening.
Right. I understand.
You know, or if I decide to do something that's super illegal and I just don't want fucking people to find me. There's that aspect to it. The other aspect to it is just, I don't like even doing this, like we're on a video call right now.
Yeah.
Makes me super uncomfortable. Because there's this big window over here, and I haven't figured out how to get rid of it. But, like, I don't like seeing myself.
Oh, I don't either. So I put the sticky app over my picture.
Oh, okay. But yeah, that's what I should do. Here, I have a little app window open. I can just put it over my own face.
Yeah, it works like a charm.
I don't. Oddly enough, I'm a photographer that doesn't like to be photographed, which is not that uncommon.
Right. I mean, I found with most people, don't you think, or most photographers are comfortable on the other side.
I think it's not. Ironically enough, it's not that most photographers don't like being photographed. I definitely don't like being photographed. And also I don't think, you know, the art's not about me.
All right.
You know what I mean?
I like that.
Yeah. Just look at the art. Like, you don't need to size me up like, you know, oh, is he a 20 something hipster? Is he, you know, whatever. You know, right. People make assumptions just based on
identity.
You know, you dress a certain way, you have a certain tattoo, your hair is a certain way, then they kind of pigeonhole you into this.
Yeah, it's easy to categorize. Right. Yeah.
You know, I mean, one of the things, when I first started doing it, and really I had not met anybody, and I was just kind of doing it on my own, there were a whole bunch of people that thought I was a girl. And I thought, that was the greatest thing ever.
Really? What about your work made them think that you would be a girl?
I think at the time, a lot of the stuff I was doing was kind of portraying sort of strong female characters. Okay. You know?
Yeah, that makes sense.
And so that went on for a few years, and I thought, oh, that's great.
Oh, you should have kept that up, like assume that identity.
I know. I wish I could, you know, it just, things changed, and I met people, and it just sort of became common knowledge, like I was nice to you.
Right.
Yeah. But,
So when I'd seen your work first, and I saw it in the gallery, and I saw it in on the street long before that, and funny enough, the longest conversation we have is just thinking of this. The longest conversation we had was here in Paris,
Yeah, right. I mean, I knew you from going to shows and seeing your work. I think I had met you maybe with Brett once or twice.
Yeah, at your studio.
Yeah. And then really the only time I ever really got to talk to you even a little bit was at the second Carpe Diem.
Yeah, exactly. And then the longest conversation we'd ever had was here in Paris last time.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and prior to that, I'd mainly seen your work in the street. And then it wasn't until one time it was at Ian Ross Gallery. You had a show there.
Right, yeah.
But it was afterwards, and the work was up in the top. And I went there to talk to him, and so I saw this entire show that was laid out. And that was the first time I realized you're both, you know, toggling between the street work and the gallery work. So that made me wonder, how does space affect your work, or does it all?
Well, anytime I did, you know, I mean, like, there was a period where I was doing commercial photography. I didn't do any street art. I didn't do anything on the street. But even as far back when I was in college, I never had much interest in being in a gallery. And not because I thought it was bad. It wasn't that interesting to me. It seemed like a very sterile environment and accessible to kind of a limited number of people. And it just wasn't that interesting to me. So I thought, well, first of all, people are busy and they have stuff to do. So why not just put work where they already are, or on their walk to work or whatever, you know, just make it easy for them. Because I think that the goal for me was like, well, how do you get people more engaged in art? Well, you don't get more people engaged in art by having an art opening where people are walking around drinking wine and sort of acting pretentious or whatever. I mean, that's just not a very inviting environment. Or at least I never found it to be very inviting.
No, I agree with that.
I mean, even, you know, particularly when I didn't belong there, when I wasn't an exhibiting artist or knew an exhibiting artist, mm-hmm. you know, I felt like it was not a place for me.
Right.
You know. So I thought, well, you know, why not just make work on the street? We can do whatever we want. And people can judge it. And it won't be this specific demographic of people. It'll be completely democratic. It'll be everybody from a school teacher to a postman to, you know, guy who's an accountant. So I think my first attempt at that, other than me being just sort of a rebellious teenager, was when I was in college. I mean, you spent some time in Oakland. You've seen these bus bench billboards.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about.
Yeah. So I thought, first I'm going to do a bunch of these bus bench billboards, you know, and I'll figure out some message to put on them and I'll do them. And then I stopped and I thought, and I was just going to do it. And then I thought, it's going to get fucking ripped down the next day. So I called up the bus bench ad company and I said, hey, I want to pitch you an idea. Like, you have a lot of, because they used to have a lot of empty ones that said, like, your ad here.
Oh, yeah. I remember.
You know, and totally. I said, So I said, I'm an artist and I want to see if you would let me use some of these empty billboards to do some art on. And they said, well, what did you have in mind? So I went down and I think the first thing I had was just this close up of this face and the mouth was zippered closed. And it said something like, is silence golden or something. This is probably like in 1990. Uh-huh. So I went in there and I showed her my little sketch. And it was just like this sort of middle-aged lady. And she was like, wow, this is great. And I was like, really? And she's like, yeah, this is great. Like, you know what? She sent me home with blanks, the blank wood to do the billboard on. She's like, here's a couple blanks. You know, take them back to your studio. Do your thing. I'm going to call our installer guy and get some plexiglass to put over these so they don't get damaged. And she literally, it was like she had two installers, guys who drove around, just workers, uh-huh. installing and stuff like that. And she was like this middle-aged woman who worked in an office in San Leandro. And she did advertising accounts and she just kind of liked art. And I don't know, she was just super friendly and was into it. And we did these fucking billboards and they stayed up forever, man. She would just leave them up. And like, if somebody else rented that space, she just had the workers take it and put it somewhere else.
It's unbelievable.
And it was like funny because it was a different time. It wasn't super corporate. Like she, that one lady could make that decision.
Yeah. Now you'd have to jump through a bunch of hoops or something.
Right. Right. And people would be like, well, I don't know what this is saying. And,
you know, right. Right.
I don't know that this presents us in a good way. And there would be five people that had to sort of, you know, check off on it. No, it was just a different time. She was like, yeah, this is cool. Let's put a bunch of these up.
And what year was this? Like early 90s?
Like 90.
Wow. Which is crazy because it doesn't seem that long ago, but it kind of is.
But, you know, it was not, there wasn't, you know, we weren't on the internet. We didn't have cell phones. And the lady was cool. I had an opening like a year later. She came to the opening, you know.
Oh, that's cool.
And there's still people like that. People who just, you know, I find in France there's a lot of people like that. People who are just genuinely kind of interested in art or interested in what you're doing.
Amazing.
And are completely generous with whatever resources they have as far as helping you do something.
Yeah, that's been my experience so far.
You know.
How did you wind up coming to Paris?
Me coming to Paris was a fucking disaster.
Oh.
I am not like, I didn't study French in high school. I don't know anything about France. I never had any interest in France. Almost everything I know, I could tell you that I know about France from the movie Casablanca, which was not filmed in France.
Right.
But
right.
There were some, but there were some scenes that were supposed to be France.
Yeah.
That would summarize everything I knew about France before I went to France. I had a terrible relationship that was just falling apart in tatters. And my partner seemed to think that it would be a good idea if we just got away. That was the problem. The problem wasn't us. The problem was the location.
Right,
we
right.
just changed locations. Everything was going to fall back into place and we were going to be fine.
Yeah, I've been
there. And I didn't believe she was serious. And she said, name a place. And we were listening to the radio and Le Vie en Rose was playing.
Okay.
And I pointed at the radio and I said, there, Paris. We'll go to Paris. And because I thought I was calling her bluff. I thought she was going to say, oh, we can't go to Paris, you know. And she got on the computer and she booked two tickets to Paris.
And what year was that? And
that was in 2015.
Okay, just a few years ago. I didn't realize.
It was not that long ago, right? So here's how little I knew about Paris. It's about a week before the trip, right? And I'm sitting in a McDonald's. It was January that we were going. And I was like, fuck, does it get cold in Paris?
Actually, I had the same thoughts myself.
So I got on my phone and I looked at the weather and I was like, yeah, it's like 38 fucking degrees. And I was like, oh, shit, I have to buy some clothes. Like, I don't have any winter clothes. And I mean, the minute I landed, you know, we drove in from CDG and we went to our hotel or whatever. And I was just walking around like, this is fucking awesome. Just immediately loved it. And brought some street art. And I was just stoked at how much street art was there. Because I had just come from... me and Dave Young had gone to Bangkok.
I remember that. You guys were collaborating for a while, right?
Yeah. We did a lot of stuff together, you know. Me and Dave went to Bangkok. Well, actually, Dave planned a trip to Bangkok, and I was just in bad shape, and I heard he was going to Bangkok, and I was like, I got to get the fuck out of here. Can I come with you? Mm-hmm. And he was like, yeah, come.
Nice.
So we went to Bangkok. But Bangkok, it's like night and day. Like, people in Bangkok weren't interested in our street art at all.
Really?
I mean, not that they weren't, not in a bad way. They didn't think it was bad. I think they just, more than anything, they just seemed confused.
Right, right. Well, it's such a cultural staple here in Paris.
Right, right.
Yeah, like almost bizarre in a way.
Yeah, and I didn't know that. You know, and then when I got there, I was like, wow, this is like fucking street art mecca.
Yeah, totally.
You know? And we went around and we put shit up and but in Bangkok, it was more like me and Dave were going around and putting stuff up. And people would like occasionally talk to us. And they'd be like, what are you doing? And we'd just be like, oh, just putting up some art. And they would be like, it's an advertisement, right? And we'd be like, no. And they'd be like, well, why are you putting it up? And they'd be like, it's just art, just to look at. And they would just sort of shake their heads like, you're retarded. And just walk away.
I understand.
You know, or make just some gesture like, so stupid. Like, what are you doing? Like, you're not making any money doing this?
Right.
Went
right,
into
right.
a 7-Eleven one night in this city, Pattaya, which is like, Dave had a friend and he said, ah, oh, you should go down to Pattaya. It's cool. It's a big town. He put up some stuff down there. So Pattaya, if you don't know, it's like the biggest like sex tourism town in Thailand.
Yeah, yeah, I've heard.
So we go down there and we're like down there to put up street art. We're walking around and it's like fucking go-go bars and all this shit. We're like, this is insane. Like you walk down a street where there's like, you know, for two blocks, there's nothing but go-go bars.
Wow.
So anyway, so we're like, well, that's weird, but whatever. There's some good walls. We'll go get up, you know? So we walk into the 7-Eleven. And there's this girl behind the 7-Eleven counter, and she's like, she says, what is with you guys? We had gone in a couple of times just to get food and shit.
Uh-huh.
She says, what's with you guys? I said, what do you mean? And she said, you're not like regular people that come to Pattaya. And we said, we're not? She said, no, you came here to work. And I said, why do you think we came here to work? And she said, because you have a bucket. They had this big wheat paste bucket.
Okay, yeah, for the wheat paste.
Yeah, exactly. And so, yeah, it was like, that was her observation. She was like, most people come to Pattaya to have fun. You guys came here to work. That's weird.
The opposite, yeah.
That's how I got to Paris. And of course, the relationship that was trying to be saved just went, Paris didn't save it.
But it did, in the end, ignite something for you, right? Because Paris is pretty much seems like it's your second home. Like, you're constantly traveling there.
Yeah. And it's such a weird thing. This is what I mean about life is never what you expect. Like, you know, like I ended up going to art school maybe because my mom took an art class by chance when she went back to college. Or maybe I started stenciling because I had a job striping parking lots. Like, life is just weird. You know, and Paris literally, you know, had a different song been on the radio, maybe I would have went to Mexico.
Right, right.
You know, like I literally went to Paris because the Edith Piaf song was on, and I was just kind of being a smartass.
Man, just think if like ABBA or something came on.
Yeah, I know, exactly, right. My life would be so different, you know, or Scorpions. I could have ended up in Austria or something.
Yeah, you'd be in Hanover.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. If Wind of Change came on, it'd be different.
There's a documentary out about the Winds of, have you seen this?
Yeah. The Wind of Change documentary or podcast?
No, it's a podcast about the CIA's involvement.
Yep. I binged it.
Okay, don't give it away because it's on the list and I haven't gotten to it yet. So I ended up in Paris and I thought, well, you know, I came home and it was kind of a depressing trip and nothing really changed. And I think both parties left kind of heartbroken and disillusioned. But the consolation prize was I got Paris. And I mean, right now is the longest I've been away from Paris since then. I mean, I've been, you know, on average, I've been spending pretty much 6 months out of the year there.
How important then is traveling to your work?
You know, not.
Or did it even. Or does it play a role in it in any way?
It motivated me a lot. I owned a store here. I owned a gallery here in Oakland. I have lived in Oakland for over 20 years. And life was just very stagnant, you know, very routine. You get in that zone where I'm sure you've done this at some point in your life where you drive home from work and you have absolutely no memory of the drive.
Oh yeah, far too many times.
Yeah, you know, you stop seeing.
Yeah, yeah, everything becomes still.
So, Dave and I. So at some point, I'd run the store and the gallery with my partner. We broke up. The store went away. The gallery went away, and so I went from being this guy who was generally working about 80 hours a week on the t-shirts and the gallery and my own work, to all of a sudden just having nothing to do. And also no money. That was a little daunting, but you know.
Right.
But it was one of those things, like sometimes you have to have very dramatic things happen in your life to get you kind of off your ass.
Right.
And going.
Yep.
And it was one of these things where literally within the course of, you know, a couple of days, I didn't have a girlfriend. I didn't have a job. I didn't own a business. I didn't own a gallery. And the whole slate was just wiped clean. So I think basically what I thought was, well, now you can just, you don't owe anybody anything. You don't have any obligations. You can kind of, it's like a do-over.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, like a blessing in disguise.
You can just kind of reinvent yourself. This is a kind of crazy story, and it's not like I like to get too new agey, hocus pocus or whatever, you know, but okay. So, before that happened, about 3 weeks before that happened, I had gone on this road trip with Night Owl and Caratoes and this photographer 20, and we drove down to the Salton Sea. You know, the Salton Sea.
Yeah. Yeah. I know what that is.
Kind of all these towns and kind of just dilapidated buildings. And we just went down there to do street art because we'd always seen pictures of it. It looked like a cool place. And I was doing this somewhat apocalyptic stuff, and it seemed like the perfect environment to put those images in. Uh-huh. I mean, it looked like the world had already ended down there. So we took this road trip. I took, like, for the first time in like forever, I took like 3 days off of work, you know, and I went on this road trip with these guys, and we went out there into the desert. And, you know, it was like 120 degrees, and we're putting up street art. Caratoz was painting murals, and like came home, and I was like, that was fucking awesome. Like, that's what I want to do. I just want to go around and put up. I want to get back to it. Like, I don't want to be a shop owner. I don't want to make fucking t-shirts. I just want to get back to the fucking days of just roaming around with my fucking friends doing art. And at the time, I had been seeing this therapist because I was a little bit uninspired and, you know, whatnot. So I came to the therapist's office. I said, dude, I just did this thing. I went for 3 days with my friends. I'm fucking super stressed out because this is exactly what I want to do. And I can't fucking do it. Mm-hmm. And she was like, well, why can't you do it? And I was like, I own a business. I have these companies. I got, like, I own a gallery. I have to curate, you know, all the whole list of everything I had to do.
Yeah. Overwhelming.
And I was like, so I don't know what to fucking do now because I don't want to do this other shit anymore. Like, I'm just tired of it. You know, and this, I finally, like, and it had been like one of those inspirational dry spells where like 2 years, maybe I was just going through the motions, doing what I do, you know, or whatever. And I'd done that. And then all the other shit fell apart like 2 weeks later.
Wow. Serendipity.
Yeah. I went into the therapist's office again and she was like, that's like a fucking miracle.
Yep.
Yeah, that was like 2 weeks. You wanted everything to go away.
Now you got it.
Yeah. And I mean, like, given the situation, you know, nobody wants it. Nobody, you know, it didn't happen well. The relationship didn't end well. So it wasn't like, it wasn't exactly at the time like I hit the lottery. You know, it was very bittersweet. But in the end, I mean, I got what I wanted. And then I thought, okay, well, like, now you have that chance. You're not tied to anything. And if you don't take it now, inevitably you will be tied to something again.
Yeah, exactly.
And so I just started leaving as soon as I could. Anytime I had some money in the bank account, I just bought a plane ticket.
And what years were this? What year was this around?
2014, 2015.
Did that then open up for you? Because what immediately brought to mind was an installation you did in 2017. I think it was. And I don't know if it was One Run Tide.
Yeah, in Detroit.
It was Numeration. Was that the title of it? Numeration? Yeah. That, for me, was probably, I mean, it's one of my favorite pieces. If it was the pinnacle for me of, I think, most of the stuff I'd seen you do.
Oh, good, because I agree with you. That's the best show I ever did. It's very rare that I have the same view of my work that, you know how it is.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know if this happened to you. I'll do a show with 15 pieces in it. And often the one that sells first is one that I was kind of like, in my mind, that was a little bit of more of a filler piece.
Oh, yeah.
Like, these three were the ones I liked, like really liked. No, that was again, like, just completely coincidental thing. I was going to do a show with 1X Run, and I went out there to do it. And I produced most of the work and brought it with me. I was going to do this installation. And they had this room for me to do it in this space that they had, right? And it was old cold storage.
Okay, yeah.
So it had no windows, and it was a small cubicle, and it was all wood, like plywood. but old. Like it looked like it was maybe from the 40s.
Uh-huh.
And they said, here's the show. You can do anything you want. And I said, okay. And I started sort of sketching it out, like where I was going to put stuff. And, you know, and it had like, that show had like 90 pieces in it.
Oh, man.
And I was taking a break and it was in a big factory. And I walked up these stairs and there was this giant fucking hall, which is where I ended up doing it. And I kind of had this idea when I was doing the show that I really wanted to do this thing that was kind of very much like a memorial.
Uh-huh.
That had a somber tone to it that was almost a little bit like a funeral.
Okay.
And like I said earlier, you know, I'm an atheist, but culturally, I'm super Catholic. Everything I grew up with was Catholic.
Same
we went to church. I went to Catholic schools.
Yeah, yeah.
I was surrounded by crucifixes. and so that installation really, like, I walked up to this room and the room was perfectly divided like a church.
Uh-huh.
You know how a church always has two rows of columns and two pews on either side. And then there's a set.
Yeah. Symmetrical.
Yeah, all symmetrical. And so architecturally, although it was a factory, it was laid out exactly like a church. And I ran down the stairs and I found Jesse from 1X Run. And I said, wait, can I do it upstairs? And he's like, I don't know if we're going to, you know, it's going to be harder to get people to go upstairs. And I was like, I think it's got to be upstairs.
Uh-huh.
And he was like, yeah, if you want to do it upstairs, just do it upstairs. And it was one of those things where just literally like, I mean, do you have these episodes where like occasionally, maybe for a week or two, just everything you do is right?
Every once in a while, but definitely not as much as I would like.
No, but I'm telling you, these things happen. And that show, I'm not saying it was the perfect show or the best show in the world, but I went there with no idea of what I was going to do. I mean, some idea, but no real idea. And literally everything just fell into place. And I can look back and say, you know, oh, I had this decision to make. And in retrospect, I'll say I made the right decision. But even to the, I mean, sometimes you're just fucking lucky. The first night I was there by myself and had this big box spring from a bed, like a stripped down box spring. And I was trying to strap it to this post. And I thought, oh, fuck it. I'm not going to go find a ladder. I'll just stack these milk crates on it. And it was this backlit piece. So it had these fluorescent tubes in it. So I stacked these three milk crates. I'm working on this thing. It's like 2 o'clock in the morning. No one's around. And all of a sudden, the milk crates give. And I go flying off these milk crates, land on the concrete floor. The piece is not strapped down yet. So it falls off the post, lands on me. All the fluorescent bulbs, there's like six fluorescent bulbs, pop out, shatter around me. And I'm like, hit my head on the fucking concrete. And I get up and I was like, I think I'm okay. I think I like, and I'm like checking my body, you know, because you're kind of in shock a little bit. I'm like, I'm not bleeding. I'm not cut. I feel like I can, my feet are working. I didn't twist an ankle. And went and got another group of bulbs, and the piece was fine. It had just broken a couple of light bulbs. Mm-hmm. And it was like one of those things where it's just like, dude, if I had fallen wrong, that show just never would have happened.
Or worse, you might not be here.
Yeah, or what, yeah, I don't think it would have been that serious, but I could have, like, you know, twisted my ankle and just not been able to do an installation in a week.
Right.
You know, or broken a fucking wrist or whatever. So I don't know. I mean, there's times in life where you just think like, yeah, wow, something different is happening right now. And like I said, I'm not a new agey guy, but there's sometimes in my life where I can say that for some reason outside of logic, a number of things happened that I can't explain. So, but I mean, anyway, I mean, at that point, sort of my everything changed. And I kind of do feel that every, you know, maybe 7 to 10 years, people's lives really kind of need to be reinvented.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I kind of feel, especially if you're in the arts, you know, if you're an artist.
Yeah, and I don't even mean your art style, but I would say like, so, right. You know, I was at the end, by the time I got to the end of my photography career, I didn't like doing commercial photography anymore because I just felt that it was so artificial. And really all I was doing was, like, you know, I was like a professional liar. here's a thing, make it look better than it is. You know, here's a person, make them look better than they are. Make them more interesting than they are. And that's what a lot of commercial photography becomes. Just an embellishment of something.
Then what would you say about art that does that? You know, like some of the manifestos of the day, like looking, you know, you go to the D'Orsay, and some of them was exactly that, to do that.
What do you mean? What would I say about that art?
Like, for example, if you take traditional art, like portraiture, part of the idea was to do that, to flatter the sitter.
Yeah, yeah. But I mean, in some of those cases, that was the commercial art of the day.
Right.
You know, because if you look at where photography replaced oil painting in that sense. Mm-hmm. So there was a time when oil painting was something that wealthy people commissioned to get pictures of themselves.
Right.
And then by the 20s, a lot of those commissioned oil paintings became commissioned photographic portraits or wealthy people documenting their lifestyle. Get a really good photo of my estate. Get a really good photo of me and my automobile, my new technology.
Right, all of my things.
Right, and I think before that, a lot of people used to just have oil paintings done. They would hire an artist and say, you know, paint this beautiful picture of my estate.
Yeah, that was the role of the house artist.
Yeah, yeah. And so, I mean, honestly, I mean, one of the most important things that I think happened to painting in the history of painting is photography. I feel like the invention of photography set painters free from representation.
Absolutely.
That was no longer something that they needed to be as concerned with, because there was this new technology that did it simpler and faster and in many ways served the same purposes.
Right.
So I don't think it's any, you know, I don't think abstract expressionism happens when it happens by accident. I think a lot of that happens because of the pressure that was taken off of painters, you know, it was like a valve, like all this stuff got diverted into photography.
Yeah, it was redirected.
And then painters could start just painting. They could just start using paint.
Right. So how do you view the validity or the role of traditional art today?
I mean, I don't view it. I mean, first of all, it just depends what it is. I mean, I don't want to condemn something based on its technique or its genre. So with any technique or genre, you might find fantastic work and shit work. You know, ideologically, I don't have an issue with it. I guess it depends. I mean, you give me an example of what you would consider realistic work.
Anything coming out of an atelier, you know, that's like a classical realist, something you might refer to as anachronistic, you know, and... Or it's just realism across the board. And it's not meant to be any kind of like baited question. It's something like for myself that I think about all the time. I mean, even with myself, there's a lot of times at the end of the day walking out of the studio that I don't know. I don't know if it's the right way to put it, but I almost feel like a little bit of a liar, you know, using a photograph.
A liar in what sense?
I think just that the photograph is even still part of the process.
I mean, being part of the process is fine. I think the interesting thing about, I think one of the interesting things about art is when you sort of bring together a lot of different disciplines. So I don't know if this translates, and I don't know if you'll even agree with me having seen my work, but in a way, what I try to do is take different things and let them do what they're good at or what I like about. So in other words, I'm not somebody who necessarily has a tremendous amount of interest in drawing a very realistic portrait of you over the course of 4 days.
Why?
Because it's slow and it's tedious, and I think my mind gets distracted in that time, and I lose a little bit of my enthusiasm for something.
Okay.
So as far as things that go like that, like very specific visual descriptions, that's where I use photography, because I like the way it lets me produce quickly. It also lets me produce a lot of things In other words, if I were to draw that picture of you, at the end, I would have that one picture of you. And I might say 2 weeks from now, yeah, that's not really the best angle to have drawn John at. Mm-hmm. But I've already had this enormous amount of time invested in it.
Right.
If I photograph you, I can take 120 photographs of you, bring them home and sit with them for 2 weeks and decide what I'm really trying to do with it. Uh-huh. And then when it comes to making it into a piece, I'll use that photography to describe the very specific things about you.
Okay.
And then I'll generally use paint to express certain things. I don't know if that makes sense.
Yeah, it makes perfect sense.
And then.
And knowing your work, I can, yeah, completely see
it. And then often the material part of it is, I think, to add some element of history to it. Where I very often don't want my pieces to feel like this was something that was just made to be in a gallery. I want it almost to be presented a little bit, not all of my work, but a lot of it, you know, where the viewer has this sense that this thing had a different life before it was brought here and hung on the wall.
Yeah, like it has a history.
It has a history, right. And I think there's something about, about memories. You know, the first show that I did, which was a three-man show with Dave Young and Hugh Lehman, that was sort of this post-apocalyptic thing. Most of the pieces that I made, or the way I went about making them, was to think, well, if everything went away and people started dying at this alarming rate, how would we, the remaining people, be able to document that and remember these people? When it's all happening so fast that you can barely even keep track of it. So a lot of the work in that show was like, I made all these death masks, which are just sort of, you know, the gauze you use to make a cast if you break your arm.
Yeah, and didn't you do a video piece to accompany that? I think it was called Epilogue?
Yeah, that was the show. Yeah, and me and David did a video trailer for the show that didn't have any of the work for the show. It was just sort of like this film trailer about an apocalypse where...
Oh, okay, the context makes more sense. Yeah. I didn't know it was a trailer for the show.
Yeah, that was a video. Well, that was the video promo for the show.
Gotcha.
But I mean, a lot of it was like about that, about memory. So there was like a whole wall of driver's licenses that were just arranged in a grid, like, you know. And then there was this whole other bucket of cell phones, and there was a this sort of big fucked up video monitor that had been somewhat smashed. And there was just this loop of everybody's camera phone pictures. And it was like, so like when these things start to leave us, like how do we catalog them? How do we sort of in some way record lives that don't exist anymore?
Right.
And I think if that were to happen, you know, you would do that. You would collect. If you found somebody and you didn't know anything about them and they had passed away, in this day and age, you would pull this SD card out of their phone and look at it and try to figure out who the hell it were. You know,
how does that contrast then? Because I think in the video, there's, if I remember correctly, there's two figures you don't see, which I assume is you and David. And on one of the bodies, you take like an ink handprint.
That was another part of the show. There were just all these handprints.
Right. So then you have like this organic form of memory against this digital form of memory. Was that the intent?
Well, it was, because the idea was that, well, it, you know, say something, you know, catastrophic enough happened. Uh-huh. Perhaps, you know, things like the web would not be up and operating, or we might not have functioning computers, or, you know what I mean? Like a lot of this stuff just might not work. So when I made the work, I tried to come up with a sort of simple old technique. So the death masks are, you know, I mean, there's all kinds of historical death masks that have been made. Before photography, when someone died, just to have a remembrance of what their face looked like, they would do these things. And the handprints, and just cataloging these sort of things in very basic, low-tech ways. I think I thought about that. The Smithsonian in Washington, D.C. does this catalog of music that is made onto these very rudimentary cylinders.
Yeah, I've seen those waxing. You can play like a record. Yeah.
So that the idea being, if society collapses and all the technology is gone and it doesn't work and there's no such thing as a CD player or an MP3 player, you can literally take, like, you know, a small piece of wood and roll it across the cylinder and you'll hear the music.
Yeah, they're amazing. They're like a wax type of resin where the way it gets scratched in a record.
I mean, it's very easy to figure out. If somebody were to come across it, they could figure out, you know, it's almost like a music box. Which actually, in that show, we had a couple of music boxes as well. And that's when I started doing the work that you're seeing now, or the work that people say, you know, oh, this looks like what's going on now. You know, that's when I began doing that stuff. But it's weird for me now, because a very practical thought that I have is, I had done that work for a long time about what I thought was this sort of event that would inevitably happen. And although it didn't happen the same or as dramatically as I thought it might, it has happened. So I don't know, A, what more there is for me to say about that. And
I was just going to ask that.
I don't know that there's much for me to say. You know, I mean, I think a lot of what I need to do now is, continue on. And also, the reason that I did that work is now different, that this has happened. So I don't want this. I don't want people to, you know, so if you'd come upon my work for the first time this month, you might think, oh, all this guy does is like fucking COVID, you know, even though I might have done 2015 or whatever. And so I don't want everything I do at this point to be referential to this moment in time. So, so in a way, it's like this thing where you just have to sort of reinvent yourself.
Yeah, kind of close the chapter on this one, maybe.
I don't know. I mean, I'm not going to say yes or no, because it depends. I mean, first of all, I keep talking about this as if it's like over.
Yeah.
We might be right in the middle of it. We might be at the beginning. We don't really know at this point.
Yeah, it could be The Purge next year and Mad Max 2021.
Yeah, right.
I'm not kidding.
I don't know. I understand exactly what you mean. I mean, if it went, you know, I mean, look at the United States. If it went from what? We had 12 people with it.
Uh-huh.
And then all of a sudden it went to 1.8 million in 6 weeks. So I have to think about that, but I think in a lot of ways, maybe I get a lot more excited sort of about different kinds of things these days. I did a project in China where I just took it's a poster. It's the poster that you've seen. It's the poster that has Chinese writing with the girl with the blue mask on.
Oh, yeah. Okay. I know the one.
There's probably 100 of them in Paris.
Right.
It's just a little square poster. So when I was in Shenzhen, I took it to this oil painting village where they're just all, you know, it's a village full of oil painters. It's not a village. It's not like out in the sticks. It's an urban village. It's a neighborhood. But they all do oil paintings there. And I took that poster because it's probably the poster I've put up the most out of anything I've ever done. You know, I just always put up a dozen or so everywhere I go. So I brought him that poster and I brought it to a guy who's an oil painter. I said, you can do oil painting in this? And he was like, and we're sort of communicating through phones. We have a little translator.
Oh, like Google Translate?
Yeah, nobody in China really speaks English, and I don't speak any Mandarin. And so there was no chance of us having a conversation. But we did have this little, they have this thing called WeChat, and it has a built-in translator.
Oh, yeah.
So you just sit there and you text back and forth, and it just brings it up in your native language.
Right.
So I hired this guy to make a copy of the poster. And he made it in about a week. I think he charged me about $45. You know, it's probably like 22 inches by 22 inches. And dude, it was really good. I thought it was going to be shit, you know, but
yeah, some of those painters are amazing.
Dude, because all they do is paint all day.
Yeah.
You know, 12 hours a day.
Day in, day out.
They probably have more experience working like that in 6 months than most painters get in 6 years.
Oh yeah. 100%.
Yeah. So I brought it to him and he copied it. And then I picked up the copy and I went down the street and I gave the copy to another painter to copy this, and so on until like the sixth one was a copy of the fifth generation copy. Does that make sense?
Yeah. So each one was making a copy of the copy.
Right. And so it changed a lot over time. By the time it got to the end.
Yeah. Kind of like the telephone game.
Yeah, exactly. But the reason I did it is I was trying, and this goes back to what you were saying about this traveling influence, the work that you do. Shenzhen is sort of notorious for being like the knockoff capital of the world, you know, where you get a fake iPhone or a fake handbag or a fake this. So I was trying to understand, but in recent years, it's changed a lot, and it's not really, I think it got its sort of, it developed its expertise and a generation of sort of tech professionals by copying things. And now it's much more an innovator and, you know, sort of the Silicon Valley of the region. So the point of doing the pieces was to see that even if you attempt to copy something, if you do it enough, it naturally evolves into something else. What I was trying to do with that piece was just to sort of give an example of the evolution of Shenzhen. That even if all you're trying to do is replicate something, you inevitably veer from that and make something new. And at some point you veer from that and you just start creating. And I mean, I don't know when you went to art school, but did you copy lots of shit just as exercise?
Yeah. Master copies.
Yeah.
Did a few.
You know, even when I was a teenager, I would just try and see, you know, I'd take an album cover and see if I could draw the illustration, you know? So, I mean, that's the whole thing. And I think as a city, Shenzhen is sort of frowned upon because it's looked at as this place that just makes cheap knockoffs and avoids patents and rips off foreign technology. But it's like, I don't really think that's exactly as simple as all that. I think that all creation sort of stems. I think one of the first steps in becoming creative is copying. So that's a big, long, drawn out story. And it's not much of a picture. But like, to me, that kind of project is much more exciting at this point than making a painting.
And what about doing more video work? I believe this is your last solo show. It was here in Paris at GCA Gallery. You made pretty extensive use of video works.
Yeah, I did a couple of video pieces. I definitely like working with video. My biggest problem with video is not as proficient at it as other things. So it can become a little bit problematic that I don't necessarily have the skills to create the things that I want to create. So I'm kind of working on that, you know. And then the work becomes much different because you end up working less like an artist and more like a production team. So you have an editor, you know, or maybe you have somebody who's your cinematographer or whatever. And you're kind of overseeing things that way. And that's what happened in the last show. It was like sort of there were like two video elements. But because of my lack of expertise, you know, I had to have other people sort of put some of it together and do the editing. And, you know, we did a holographic piece. And that's a good example. Like the holographic piece comes from Shenzhen.
Oh, really? I didn't realize that.
So there's new technology that I had never seen until I went to China. So to say that Shenzhen is just a place that copies American technology is
right,
100% accurate. Right. I saw all kinds of things over there that I've never seen in my life.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think it's inevitable that through copying, at some point there's going to be something original that makes its way through, and then that just exacerbates.
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, I don't think so. So, you know, for people to sort of look, have a derogatory attitude about Chinese, and if you look at Chinese's evolution in being an industrialized nation, it's very young. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, in 1975, China was a very different country.
Right.
So sometimes, occasionally, being in a place does sort of dictate the art. I did some other pieces there that I don't read Chinese, so I would go around to these abandoned buildings and sort of find signs or banners or old billboards. I bring them back to the studio and I'd kind of collage them together and maybe do a piece on top of that. And the idea was that, you know, if you just collect debris from an area, what will it tell you about the place? Mm-hmm. So the fun part of that was I have no idea what any of the signs that I was using said. So I didn't know how well they related to the place of Shenzhen or not, you know. And then I was at a residency. Uh-huh. So I would ask the people at the residency, like, don't tell me what this says until I'm done, you know, and I would put the piece together. And then I would have to say, all right, can you translate some of this for me? And they would come in and they would tell me what it meant. And it didn't always work, but in a couple of examples, the text in many ways really told you a lot about Shenzhen.
For example,
I did one piece, and I think at the end when we took all the text off, and I'm not going to be able to remember verbatim, top had a little piece in the newspaper about President Xi, and then there was a piece from a placard in an office that said "Accept no excuses." That was about work ethic. And then there was a big part of a billboard that basically said "The good life can be yours." And then there was another piece of a poster that basically said like "Good wealth and good business." Uh-huh. And in many ways, that really describes the sort of ethos of Shenzhen. It's a place that people came to for economic opportunity.
Right.
You know, like, I don't know what you know about it, but it's a city that basically didn't exist in 1979. And now it's a city of like 16 million.
Yeah.
But it's like, you know, so sometimes it works. It's like sometimes you get these little shreds of the culture's ideology just in posters and billboards or a piece of a newspaper, and you're kind of able to digest the place. Or give an impression of the place that's somewhat accurate to it, but in its own words, if that makes sense, kind of.
Yeah, makes perfect sense.
But for me as an artist, I mean, it was fascinating because you work on the piece and you're working on it visually, and you have to wait till the end to find out what the hell it means. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That's exciting. I don't know that it's exciting to every audience, but I think it's exciting.
No, I think it's amazing. And lastly, now that we're coming to the end, the next Carpe Diem is coming up. And originally that was going to be opening up here in Paris, but then because of the COVID situation, that's changed. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. So on June 20th, we're putting together this online event called Carpe Diem, which is sort of, this is a new version of something we've done a few times. You know, generally we have 10 or 20 artists come to a gallery. The gallery stays open for 24 hours, and they create their works in 24 hours, and that's the exhibition.
Yeah.
And we were planning to do that at Fluxuart in Paris in April, which obviously was not possible, and got canceled, which was super disappointing. But me and Frederick Steimer, who... I think you met at Fluxuart one day.
Yeah, I've met him a couple times.
Yeah, we started talking to some guys that we know who are IT guys, because neither of us are, and they started talking about ideas that we could do this as sort of a live event. You know, having people stream from their workplaces or their studios or even the street if they're doing a mural or something like that. So on June 20th, for the 24 hours of June 20th, we're going to have 150 artists live streaming sort of on their own channels on Instagram, and then also on a YouTube channel that we've put together that will
of
bounce around back and forth between what's going on in the different studios.
Also, it'll somehow be pinging their IG lives,
yeah,
Instagram lives, and then feed it through.
What we're able to do with the YouTube channel is we can kind of grab an IG live feed and just drop it in there.
Okay.
Podcast that.
That's amazing.
Yeah. I mean, it's really cool. We have a friend in Paris, Didier, who's a developer, and he was showing like kind of what the possibilities are. But then we also are having everybody live stream. You know, they're going to be live on their own individual IG channel, which I think is nice for the viewer because they can kind of go and see the artists that they're interested in. Obviously, they're not going to be interested in all 150 artists or have the time to see that. So they can say, oh, you know, I like John Wentz and I like, you know, Jody Bona and I like Brett Amory. I'll just look at what those guys are up to. And so it's kind of going to function a little bit like a telethon. Like during the live performances, we're going to be encouraging people to donate to the Foundation for Medical Research in Paris.
Right.
And they have 24 research projects going on right now to sort of understand COVID.
24?
Yeah.
Just dedicated to that. Wow.
And I'm not a scientist, so I don't understand in depth that all of those, you know, but I think they, from vaccines to everything else, to sort of mapping the virus itself. And so I wanted to do it mainly because I've been so disappointed in our government's commitment to science that I thought, well, you know, can we bring some people together and try and help science? So it's a fundraiser for that. Also, many of the artists are donating pieces that will be for sale on monart.com, which is also a French site, but an art sales site.
Right. And a percentage of that's going?
So 70% of that will go to the foundation for medical. Okay. 30% will go to the artists, because Frederick and I kind of both agree, like, every time there's a crisis, artists are asked to do all this shit for free.
And yeah,
that's a little bit unfair considering their sort of general economic standing.
Right. Yeah. It's usually so below average.
People with the least amount to donate the most.
Yeah. Yeah.
A little bit ridiculous. So we decided that, you know, 30%, at least 30% should go to the artists. So.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah. What's the name of the website again? I didn't quite get it, that it's going up on.
Monart. So monart.com.
Ah, okay.
And then the donation page, we're using kind of what's similar to a GoFundMe in France called Gandhi, G-A-N-D-E-E.
Yeah.
And so we're going to have everybody post that. And basically, like I said, it'll function in two ways. It'll be like a telethon, a call to, you know, if you can make a donation, please do. Both the websites we're working with agreed to not take any kind of commission or anything for the work.
That's great of them.
So, yeah. So 100% of the donations will go to the foundation, and then they will do the transactions for the art sales, and that will go to the artists and the foundations with no fees involved or anything like that. So it should be pretty fun, you know, but it's a little bit of uncharted territory. Like I said, we're no tech guys. So, but
yes,
we're going to keep everybody informed, you know, through the Facebook page and the YouTube channel, Instagram, you know, who's going to be on and who's going to be live and where they can go see them. And then people have a sort of invitation into your studio to see how you work.
Right. And you've been on the Carpe Diem's Instagram, you've been posting all the participating artists, right?
Yeah. So
people can go on there and see.
Yeah, we're doing that. That gets updated a couple times a day, give you an idea of who's going to be performing that day, and also who's going to have work available online. So, I mean, hopefully we can raise a decent amount of money in it. You know?
Hopefully.
I think our goal was to somehow just sort of bridge what we do as artists with the importance of what science and medical research does, and, you know, how much we depend on them and need them.
Yeah, especially in times like this.
So the one positive thing I think I've done throughout this is to, you know, work on the Carpe Diem thing with Frederick, and hopefully we can contribute in a way, you know, have the art community sort of express its gratitude towards the science community.
Awesome, man. Yeah, I think it's going to be great. I think that's a great way to end it. So, thanks again, Eddie. It was great talking to you, man.
Thanks for having me, man.
Lo-Fi Sight and Sound Podcast is an American artist living in Paris, France, in conversation with artists, musicians, and filmmakers discussing context, the creative process, and studio practice. You can find us on all streaming platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Stitcher. Also at www.lofipodcast.com, no hyphens. Please rate and review. It helps more than you know. If you can't rate and review, then please share this with a friend. Lo-Fi Podcast is recorded, mixed, and edited by myself. Intro music is also by me. Thank you for listening.